Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Jester J. Schreeder. Today, on episode 360, we are here to discuss Vuity, the recently approved eye drop for the treatment of presbyopia. There have been a couple of reports recently of retinal complications after the use of Vuity, and it brought on the authors of those reports to discuss the drop and the implications of those findings. Remember that you can find this podcast episode on our website, retinapodcast.com. You can claim CME credits for this podcast episode by clicking on the link in the episode description. That will take you to the American Academy of Ophthalmology website to claim those credits. And you can find a list of financial disclosures relevant to every episode in the episode description. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is back with another episode and here to discuss some complications that emerged in the retina space related to a new drug hot in the anterior segment world. Joining me for this episode, I've got two fellows in an attending. First, in alphabetical order, Dr. Haas Alkerson, who's a second year retina fellow and chief resident at Bascom Palmer. Haas, welcome.
Thank you.
Next, Dr. Suzanne Michalak. She's a second year fellow in vitreoretinal surgery at Stanford University. Suzanne, welcome.
Thank you. Excited to be here.
And last but not least, making a return to the podcast, Dr. Rasan Rahimi. Dr. Rahimi is faculty at Stanford University and at the Palo Alto Medical Foundation, where he's a vitreoretinal surgeon. Rasan, welcome back.
Thanks for having us on, Jay, to talk about this kind of exciting new issue. Good to see everyone here.
So let's talk about, let's dive right in. So we were here to talk about Vuity. Vuity is a drug that was released within the last year. Very, very hot in anterior segment world for any retina doctor who's been living under a rock for the last year. Ihsan, tell us a little bit about what Vuity, what is it? What is it approved for? And how is it dosed? What's sort of the utilization that you've observed in your population?
Definitely. I think for those of us in the retina community who aren't as familiar with this medication, I'm almost sure that we've all heard about it from our patients. I mean, I think we'd all agree it's been almost a near daily occurrence for our patients to be asking us about this medication, soliciting for our opinion about it, whether they can get a prescription for it, or they're already reporting it as a new medication that they're taking, either by virtue of kind of the direct-to-consumer marketing that we've seen from AbbVie, like with launch of commercials for this, or just from virtue of their optometrists who have brought this up with their patients and have been prescribing it. So this medication is just dilute pilocarpine. You know, this isn't anything brand new to the field of ophthalmology. And even in the field of retina, we know that there are historically some potential retina risk associated with the use of pilocarpine, but Vuity is 1.25% pilocarpine. It's specifically indicated for the treatment of presbyopia. This was approved by the FDA back in October of 2021. So, you know, since then we've seen a ramp up in the direct-to-consumer marketing on the heels of its approval. And this is based off of the backbone of their clinical trials, which I'm sure we're going to talk about, the Gemini and Gemini 2. And they've most recently done a follow-up study of, which is called the Virgo trial, testing a twice-a-day formulation, whereas the Gemini 2 is a once-a-day formulation of this medication.
Great. So pilocarpine is a drug, Haas, that we all learn about in residency. Maybe we observe it being used more in the glaucoma space than anywhere. I mean, now in the presbyopia space being utilized. But it does carry some side effects that retina specialists definitely are familiar with and have either read about or seen. We just don't see that many patients taking pilocarpine regularly. So most of it has been book knowledge, not necessarily personal observation. But now with more patients taking Vuity, I think there's a concern that you can get some of those complications. You were the first author in a recent case report and or description in American Journal of Ophthalmology of an occurrence that happened with Vuity. You want to tell us a little bit about the side effect there and what happened?
Yeah, so we had, there were several side effects initially that kind of prompted its discontinuation in the glaucoma world, really, except for, I think pretty rare cases. Initially, the reason people stopped using it mostly was that patients get kind of a brow ache with frequent use. But one of the other kind of complications that's been reported is that there's basically contraction of the ciliary body as well as the pupillary sphincter, which is how patients essentially get that pinhole effect. But that's thought to shift the kind of vitreous body forward. And one of the possible complications of that is, you know, it can lead to traction on the retina, and potentially retinal tears and retinal detachments. So I was in Dr. Townsend's clinic, and we had a patient who presented with bilateral retinal detachments, which, you know, I've seen on occasion. It wasn't the first time, but it was just very odd. And when I, you know, he had cataract surgery a few months ago, but it was uncomplicated. And the other eye, he was phakic. And the odd thing was they were concurrent. And so, you know, we kind of were inquiring initially about trauma. He said no. He was in his mid-40s, but he did mention that several weeks prior, about 4 weeks prior, he had started the Vuity drops. And he had mentioned that actually 3 days after starting in both eyes, he started having flashes and floaters, didn't think much of it. And then it evolved in one of his eyes into kind of a curtain. And then that's what prompted him to come and see us. And we discovered that he had the bilateral retinal detachments. And it was very interesting in this particular case because he had been seen in clinic prior, and both eyes were examined. In those cases, he didn't have posterior vitreous detachments, which he did have when he presented with his retinal detachments. So, you know, when we wrote up the cases, we were very clear to say that obviously this is not necessarily causation, but this is certainly correlation that prompts further investigation, which was kind of the point of the case report there.
Yeah, great description, and we're going to dive into that in a minute. It's not going to tell us more globally what's happened. Suzanne, you were involved with Dr. Rahimi in writing up different sort of association, right? So Haas talked about that shift of the everything sort of moving forward inside the eye, and that shift that can affect the vitreous body. You probably published a series in OSLI Retina looking at this. What did you observe from a side effect profile, and what were the implications of that for those patients?
I think Haas explained it really well. As you just recapped, you know, it's anterior displacement of the vitreous, which can cause traction on the retina. So, I mean, I think for patients particularly who haven't had a posterior vitreous detachment in the past, they're particularly at risk for a sudden posterior vitreous detachment, which can lead to things like sudden macular hole formation or vitreomacular traction, or of course, as you guys saw, retinal tears or retinal detachments. I think Haas also made a really good point that it's difficult and a bit dangerous this early to kind of claim causation. I think ours was a little more in close proximity to the event. So our patient was a 65-year-old optometrist actually who put in a drop of Vuity. And then about 10 minutes later, she noticed a new onset scotoma. And then she took her own OCT, which showed that she had a little bit of vitreomacular traction and a new subfoveal EZ irregularity, which corresponded to her new scotoma. So while we still can't really say that it's definitely the Vuity that caused it, I think being such a close temporal association makes it likely that instilling the drop caused sudden anterior displacement of the vitreous, which then put a little traction on the fovea, resulting in the new scotoma.
Full props to the optometrist for trying it out while prescribing it to the patients. I don't know if I, Hassan, I'd be trying any of our new intravitreals, for example, on myself before I gave it to a patient.
The other part that's interesting about that story too, Jay, is, mind you, she put it bilaterally, right? In both eyes, and had acute onset scotoma within 10 minutes. So what about the fellow eye? The interesting story there is that eye has a history of a previous PVD and multiple repairs. So the eye that got the symptomatic VMT had not yet had a vitreous separation. So it's very strongly suggestive in our opinion, but again, of course, yeah, be careful with, you know, correlation and causation and how you label these things.
Yeah, it's interesting, Hassan, you mentioned the history of the fellow eye. We've observed for a long time in retina specialists that there is sort of a correlation between patients with a quote unquote abnormal vitreous retinal interface as well. Patients who tend to get vitreomacular traction and macular holes are also patients who tend to be at risk for retinal tears and detachments. They're not a complete Venn diagram overlap, but there is a little bit of overlap in sort of that quote unquote stickier vitreous. So I wonder, Hassan, and I'm curious what has been collected nationally. I wonder if this will lead to any change in sort of indications for this drop. I wonder if you could risk stratify patients. Maybe it's better not to use this, for example, in a patient who doesn't have a PVD and is potentially at higher risk for a tear or detachment, like a high myope. Maybe it's a better idea if a patient has a history of VMT, MAC, cola, RDNY, not to use this. if the fellow eye doesn't have the hyoid up. I wonder if there are certain modifications that would need to be made to sort of address and reduce the risk of patients developing these issues.
Yeah, these are very, very important points. I think that's kind of what we're getting to is like, okay, you know, this drop is here. We're not trying to say that it's bad or that it doesn't work for people. I'm sure many patients who are using it are hopefully happy with the results, but clearly it's not for everybody either. And one way of kind of tracking how things are going on a national level is just monitoring the FDA's adverse events reporting system, the FAERS. And as of the last update from June 30th, there have been like over 425 complications, quote unquote, reported related to Vuity use. 71 of them have been labeled as being serious. And then when you actually break down based on what is the complication, we have at least like 19 retinal detachments in there. 6 retinal tears, several vitreoretinal tractions, and then others that are called like visual field defects. So that's about as granular as you can get on their website. Separate from that, we've been like working with the ASRS REST committee, like encouraging, you know, via publication in some of these lay retina journals, just encouraging colleagues, if you come across cases, to report it to them. Because I know this is something that's been on their radar. But to your point, like, what do we do with this in terms of actionable items? In the clinical trials, doing OCT imaging was absent. I think that was, I think, one of our biggest criticisms of all these studies is, I think they did an entry dilated fundus exam and then an exit dilated fundus exam. But we all know that is not sufficient to pick up some of these vitreoretinal interface diseases, especially things like mild VMT or even early macular holes. So at least one of our recommendations is all patients before starting this probably should have a baseline OCT to assess the hyoid status, see if there's already VMA or even mild VMT. Definitely, as you said, Jay, if somebody has a previous history of any kind of problems, be it tear, macular hole detachment in one eye, I would even argue if there's a family history of it, you probably want to exercise some caution and discuss that with the patient as being a small but very real potential risk that could happen after using the medication.
Yeah, those are great points. And it brings up the point, I think people laugh because retina specialists, just like all subspecialists, are biased in terms of what we think every patient should get. I think there's cornea doctors out there who think every patient deserves a PACI and a SPECT mic. There are glaucoma doctors out there who believe everyone should have a field in RNFL. And for retina doctors, it's macular OCT. But I think this is true for a lot of indications. This is sort of, you know, we're a small field in ophthalmology, but we get really subdivided. And I really think that this is, we see patients all the time, unfortunately, Hassan, who go for refractive surgery, cataract surgery, go for procedures to address issues and don't get a baseline macular OCT. And I think retina folks have the humility at this point to understand there's a lot of information that you can pick up on OCT that even the best dilated fundus exam just isn't able to pick up with the same degree of specificity or sensitivity. And then I think that our anterior segment colleagues sometimes just don't think of getting OCTs. And I don't mean that as a criticism. Again, I'm saying every field sort of has its blind spots. But I think this is another good example in terms of the trial design. To us, it seems obvious as retina folks. We're like, okay, you definitely should have an OCT as a baseline test. But I guess what we should talk about in a minute is what does it mean for, I guess, the other sort of trials we see, right? But I guess this should have been maybe anticipated given the history of side effects with pilocarpine in the past.
And just to jump here, Dr. Sridhar, just to say too, you know, other than things to kind of add in terms of kind of, you know, pre-prescription testing or all of that is just discussions with the patients. I think one of the most interesting and kind of alarming things that both of the cases that we reported had said was that this was not at all discussed as a possible risk with the patients. And both of them said that if they had known it was a risk, they might not have, you know, they might have reconsidered. And on the FDA label, it does say that miotics, it doesn't say specifically pilocarpine, have been known to be associated with retinal detachment. So I think at the very least, prescribers should tell patients about these, you know, possible symptoms. And then if people want to proceed with that understanding of the risk, that's fine. But I think that discussion should be had with the patients for sure.
Yeah. Suzanne, I'm curious, you know, one of the things Dr. Rahimi brought up was direct-to-consumer advertising, right? And I think direct-to-consumer advertising is something we've talked about in the program. I think a lot of physicians feel strongly that that's probably not the right way to approach it, but it's just becoming more and more common, whether it's TV or traditional print media. But now we're going to see it in social. We're going to see it on Twitter. We're going to see it on TikTok. We're going to see it on Instagram. That's much harder to regulate what is and what isn't a direct advertisement to a patient. And I think this is sort of a case that illustrates that it's You know, I think it's really challenging because we put drugs through a review. We put them through a certain standard they have to reach to become approved from a safety and efficacy standpoint. And yet you can't pick up every issue in a trial when you're dealing with a few hundred patients, or even 1,000 ophthalmology patients, versus when you go to the real world and tens and thousands of patients are seeing a video or seeing an ad and deciding to use a drug. You may see things. And I'm not saying that the companies are disingenuous again. I just think that maybe this adds caution. Maybe if there is direct-to-consumer advertising, maybe there should be some sort of latent period. Like there's a period where you just can't do it for the first 6 to 12 months the drug is out, because that would avoid some of the snowball effect where now all of a sudden you have to kind of go back to the drawing board and say, hey, this is a problem. And we've seen this in retina, maybe not with direct-to-consumer advertising, but with brolucizumab, for example. I think it's always challenging when you adopt a drug and now you're utilizing on a wider scale. So I'm just curious, Suzanne, your thoughts on kind of the approval process and how you sort of A, adopt new drugs, and B, how we should handle how we approach patients with this new information.
Yeah, I mean, I think you bring up a lot of really interesting points in that. I think one of the ones is for the direct-to-consumer advertising, I guess it depends how effective you think it is. So whether or not this sudden like increase in prescriptions right after it was approved was due to the patients being aware of it, or was due to all the direct-to-consumer advertising that then made them ask their optometrist or ophthalmologist about it and then get prescribed. So I think in that case, even if you delay it 6 months, maybe that no one comes in asking for it and the doctors aren't really pushing it, so it doesn't get prescribed for 6 months. So then the snowball effect of adverse events wouldn't really happen until whatever time limit you set for when the advertisement would come out. And then even if that were a year or two afterwards, the uptake might not be until that time. Mm-hmm. And then you might still get the same impact.
That's true.
I think as far as social media, that's also a really interesting question. Of course, there are going to be some patients with every medication who loves it and tells the world about it. You know, one thing I heard early on that was interesting when I was in high school and like volunteering in the hospital is that usually if someone has a bad experience, they'll tell 10 people about it. And if they have a good experience, they'll tell maybe one person about it. Huh. I think I saw some things that one of the patients Haas wrote about actually has like a blog and has told a bunch of people and is really trying to get the word out on Facebook about the adverse events. So, I mean, it might just be... I think it puts you in a really hard position as a physician. You know, it's not like, oh, something bad happened to you. Maybe you should tell all of your friends that they shouldn't use it. So you don't really want to advocate for that either. But patients, I think, have power both ways to both share information about medications that they find are helpful to them and that they feel like they've had an adverse event that wasn't fully explained to them. But again, puts physicians in a hard place because I think we know for all of our, like consenting patients for every procedure, we never go through the 100 little things that can happen. Yeah. We try to do the most common ones, but it's hard. And then the last thing about the direct to consumer advertising I thought was interesting as well, is that in their ad, usually at the end, I'm used to them saying like 10 things really, really, really fast can go wrong. In Vuity, it just says like, if you have vision loss, contact your doctor. I think it might have been helpful. Sorry.
I mean, that covers everything. It covers a lot of things.
It's true.
You know, Ehsan, I'm going to have my old man get off my lawn moment since I'm going to you know, these two young retina doctors here will probably laugh at me, but you'll understand this. So, I mean, there are new problems with social media that Suzanne was alluding to. Yes, a patient who had a negative experience may tell 10 people versus the person who has a good experience tells one. But things get murky now with influencers, right? So what if you contact a social media influencer and say, hey, we sent you some free Vuity to try out. If you'll, you know, it's up to you if you want to talk about it or not, because for compliance reasons, we can't tell you to talk about it, but they'll talk about it if you send it to them. And I think that this is already happening. This is happening in other industries. It's starting to happen with pharma. It's a really slippery slope. And I think it's really hard because these people are technically not employed by industry. There's no money trail because they're not being paid necessarily. But they are, this is what influencing is. It's different. It's an exchange of views for product. It's an exchange of opportunity to grow my base if I showcase what you want to sell. And I think that's so much harder for, especially the people making policies are 30, 40 years older than Haas and Suzanne here. They're not going to understand, as we saw when Zuckerberg was in front of Congress, what any of this is about. So I think the policies are going to lag, but this is really something that needs to be addressed because it's going to happen. And it's already happening. It's just going to snowball. And patients, unfortunately, believe what they see on social, just like physicians tend to be, like any person tends to believe the things they read or see or hear on a daily basis.
I think it's such a a critical point you just made, and each of your points has relevance even with beauty. So first off, I did see a number of eye care providers, if you will. I think social media probably has a stronger, more heavy lean towards optometrists being represented there. But even still, there's a plenty of ophthalmologists on there. I saw both sides, some big name accounts with, you know, tens of thousands of followers openly promoting beauty and not saying much about it. So that's to one end. Second thing is you talk about how pharma is identifying social media, be it Instagram, Facebook, whatnot, as mediums of platform for potential advertising or patient engagement. And it's not to pick out a company, because I think this is something all the big companies in our field are looking at, but Allergan already openly does it. And on these posts, you will see the provider. You're obligated to say, I'm a paid consultant working with Allergan on this, but Allergan has already identified the space. They are openly engaging with providers that are on social media with a stronger presence as a means to connect to patients. And you're totally right. This is a murky field. And I think this is coming to reality for ophthalmology. I mean, I don't think we were at the top of the pecking order for industry. That was probably things that you'd think social media is stronger for, like plastic surgery, dermatology, these type of things. But here it is. It's in ophthalmology right now. And I'd even argue beyond regular eye care, it's coming into retina. I think with the onslaught of potential, you know, additional intravitreal Me Too agents coming out, companies are looking for an edge or ways to promote their product. They are exploring all avenues to do that, including social media engagement. And then on top of that, when you look at potential therapy coming for dry AMD, that's going to be a whole new space. And as we know, the companies entering this field are looking for ways to maximally engage with this potential patient population, which is going to include, how do we identify their loved ones or their caregivers? And where are these people? They're likely to be on social media looking for things. So this is very real in ophthalmology, but especially in retina.
That's a great point. And I would add refractive surgery. I mean, I feel like I see a lot of people on LinkedIn, on Instagram, definitely, a lot of refractive surgeon colleagues of ours who are talking about things that I just don't have the intelligence to talk about, you know, light adjustable lenses and smile and the newest refractive procedures. And again, there's sort of that give and take, right? So is there an exchange of money? Maybe not. Maybe someone's just talking about the product because they want to showcase, but it's part of building your brand, right? So you're building your brand as that person, which gives you greater visibility, but you're also, it's sort of this mutualistic symbiotic relationship, and it can be really fruitful for someone who's a young retina specialist or young ophthalmologist or somebody who's just trying to grow their practice, right? To get more visibility and grow their brand. We've talked in other settings about growing your brand. It's important for individual people in different settings, but you're sort of growing the company's brand, and the company comes back and strokes your back, and there may not actually be exchange of money. So it's really hard to track, unlike Sunshine Act reporting and other ways that we track consulting.
And you're right. I mean, this is truthfully the wild, wild west. And it's not to say that it's going to be bad, but police it, right? How are we going to regulate it? And I don't think that that's well understood right now. And there is a lot of gray area here where, as you mentioned, there's some very real conflicts, even if you can't directly, you know, tie a money trail to these things.
Yeah. Suzanne or Haas, any final thoughts from either of you?
No, I mean, I agree. I'm just glad that everyone, you know, is talking about this. And I think one other kind of just a little tidbit from putting that case report together, because as far as I was aware, I think that was one of the first reports, and it was a little bit intimidating, honestly, to kind of, you know, put this out there, and you kind of hear rumblings from people about, you know, the case reports and, oh, this is not the cause, even though, again, we hedged our claims, pretty broadly saying that this was not at all an accusation, but when there's so much money involved in these industries, it can kind of be very intimidating.
Yeah. Suzanne, go ahead.
I was going to say, I would for sure agree with that point that we've just been trying to tread really carefully until it's clear that there's an obvious correlation that can't be refuted, because otherwise you're making big claims against people who have a lot of power and are very important to us in our everyday lives too. We rely on them to continue innovating and helping us help our patients too. So I think it's taught me a lot about treading carefully, but also investigating things that you're worried might harm patients.
I was just going to say, you know, not to only look at it in a negative light, right? Like Suzanne said about positive and negative experiences, there are plenty of patients who have had positive experience on this drop in this medication, and you don't want to just like completely slam something as well too. So I just think it's going to require just thoughtful consideration, maybe better screening before we start patients on it, and trying to identify and eliminate, or at least better counsel high-risk patients before even letting them consider this.
Yeah, that's a great point. I'll just end by saying, I mean, I want to first compliment the three of you. It's tough to take on a difficult topic like this. You talked about you do want to maintain those relationships. You don't want to imply causation from a scientific standpoint, but the pressure is real. And it's a little sad, but it's the real world. There's always that pressure. You know, I'll end with an apocryphal story, which may or may not be true. And Hassan will maybe know about this story, but I remember someone I knew who was around our time in fellowship, who presented a study regarding cost analysis of different drugs, and presented on the podium, and had a company rep walk up to this person and say, you know, you have to be really careful what sort of things you present, because it's going to eliminate opportunities for you in the future if you continue to do this. And it was really striking and sobering at the time, right? I mean, this is a real thing. And I don't think most of our partners, like Suzanne, I think most of our partners are not like that. I think they want to take good care of patients. They want to innovate. They want to push the field forward. But you know, there are different goals for industry investors and industry people than physicians on the whole. We're often on the same team, but often our goals do not completely overlap in terms of what we want to achieve or what we're trying to get done. And we've seen that in different instances. It's a rare event. Like Hassan said, most of these patients are pretty happy, and most of the drugs we bring to market do really, really well. But it's important that I think we gain a lot of respect as physicians for the companies that do step up, and when there are issues, are willing to take ownership and are willing to investigate and are very open about being transparent, because I think that builds a lot of trust and shows that they're on the same page in terms of, you know, making the field better and making our patients have better outcomes and avoiding complications.
Very well said, Jay. Agree 100%. Shout out to Brian Hong for that study.
And here I was trying to be discreet. Dr. Haas Alkhirsan, Suzanne, Michael Ack, and Hassan Rahimi, thanks so much for your time. Thanks for your publications, and hope to have you on soon. Take care.
Thanks, Dr.
Thanks a lot, Jay.
Thank you.
Many thanks to Drs. Alkhirsan, Michael Ack, and Rahimi for joining me for this episode. Remember, you can find all 360 of our episodes. Yes, there are 360 now of our episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. You can find all 360 episodes listed there and sorted by category. In addition, we're on your favorite podcast app on your Android or Apple device. Remember, you can find us on Facebook or on Twitter at Retina Podcast. And you can email us directly at retinapodcast@gmail.com with any episode ideas, or click on the Contact Us link on our website. Listeners, thank you for what you do on a daily basis, the articles you read and publish, and the conversations you inspire here each week. This is Jay Schreeder, signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.